Welcome to the Car, Sim and Race Driver Show, presented by Hugh Hattrick. Drive fast and try not to crash.
To all our viewers and listeners of the Car, Sim and Race Driver Show, and we have a very special guest on our show tonight. It is none other than James Ruppert. Welcome to the show, James. It's great to have you back.
Good evening, Hugh. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Yeah. Well, you're fresh from a very, very big podcast with James Dellingpole. I think one of the biggest, kind of the more political podcasts out there. And you survived all of that. And now you've come onto the show with me. So there we are. But it's great to have you on the show. You've just written a new book, which is Demotorized. To give our viewers a chance of what it's all about, what's the main theme of the book?
It's basically sticking up for the motorist. The subtitle of it is the 200-year war on the motorists, because I do find that us poor old motorists are the subject of a lot of persecution, whereas actually, you know, driving, we drivers are fantastic. I mean, the car has made such an important contribution to our way of life. It allows us to work. It allows us to socialize. It gives us so many benefits. And yet constantly we're being attacked, certainly in the media and by governments. And we're a very easy taxable unit. And the thing is, we go along with this and we think, yeah, we've got to pay our car tax. We've got to pay this tax, that tax. But the roads aren't better, are they? You spend most of your time driving around potholes. So the point of the book was, I mean, last year, when there was an all-party report on the car, and they sort of basically said, we want to end private ownership of the car. And I went on BBC Five Live to stick up for the car. And I was confronted with, a lot of, aggression and a lot of negativity, and I couldn't believe that. And so I had no intention of writing this book, but I felt compelled to do it. I felt compelled on behalf of the motorists, because I thought they're so beleaguered. I've got to set the record straight, because we're attacked from so many angles. So that was the point of actually writing the book. I just wanted to say to people, there you go. That's why the car is good, and making it history. There's some jokes in there, so it's not a dry read. Although some people have said it's my serious album compared to most of my other books, which it could be. But the point of it is just to put the other reason why we should all say thank you to the car, and maybe we can fight back in some way, shape, or form. But I hope people enjoy it when they read it.
So we might get... Well, so there we are. We were talking about how there's this huge attack on the motorist and how... And it seems to be... I don't think it's just people just in the cities, but they have that kind of city point of view that, they think all the roads are clogged up. And my kind of bugbear is when I have to go up to Edinburgh every week, it's not so much that there's all this traffic everywhere. It's the systems that they've put in. And then they have the nerve to then blame us for daring to travel around a city. They put in a bus lane, they put in traffic lights everywhere, where before it was an easy roundabout and you just kind of turned and, the traffic was, it was still busy, but it kind of moved. And now when they put these bus lanes in and traffic lights everywhere, nobody can move. So, you're getting these huge queues of traffic where before it kind of moved quite easily. And I mean, it was quite funny. It took me 50 minutes to get from the docks at Leith, where there's a big shopping centre, and it was only 3 miles to get to the A1, which is in the south of Edinburgh. It took me 50 minutes to get there, and then 45 minutes to get home, and it was 45 miles to get to my house. So it shows you that as soon as you get to a reasonable road and you can go, you can get out there. And they've just clogged up the cities with these kind of bus lanes and bus schemes, and it never seems to work. And of course, if you're in the countryside, as you said, you could hardly get a bus, or it's going to be quite expensive. What do you find is your biggest bugbear in where you are?
Well, yeah, it is. It's just that if I wanted to get somewhere, you know, by train, well, I've got to drive to the train. So, you know, most of the, so I don't take a train because someone's going to drop me off, or I've got to park at the train station. There's not always parking there. There are no buses. There's no coaches, but that's fine. I made the decision to live where I live, which is fine. And I like it because actually the driving roads are pretty good around me. But you are right. Once you go into a city, and there's a big city near me, and when I first arrived in this area, it was great. You're correct. You could drive all the way in, and then they put a bus lane in, they put this lane in, and they put restrictions in, and it's all done as, you know, as a deliberate demoralizing effect, so that you think, oh well, I'll just park and ride. Or but what actually ends up happening with all of these things is that people will just don't go, part of what they're doing will kill off little towns, it will kill off cities, because people just go to retail parks, and you can understand why, because it's great, you can go and park, whereas everywhere else it's a huge faff.
So much easier to get to. I try and avoid the town as much as I can, because it just, especially anywhere near rush hour, and you're stuck. You know, but before you kind of get away with it, when I used to live in the city and I had a little car, I had a little Fiesta, 1986 C-plate Fiesta. It was so thin and the mirrors were so small, you could kind of get it through the gaps, and you'd be so much more aggressive in those days, and you never get stopped. But now you get on every camera, and, you know, that bit, your license gone in a few minutes. But before you, unless they saw you do a funny move, they couldn't prove anything.
No, that's right. Well, I think again, that's the reason for writing the book. I just found that sort of everything is sort of against us now. And unfortunately, me and you are so old, we remember when driving was relatively free. And if you try and explain to people, well, years ago, you know, these restrictions weren't here, you know, we could get to places quite easily. They don't believe you, but, you know, we are watched to an incredible extent. And because, as you say, because of the AAMPR cameras, I think, you know, for certain things, it's a great, a system to catch bad people. But there's actually a lot less police around. So you might be, you know, and cameras aren't very discerning. You know, a camera can't see the reason why you might have done something. You know, they don't know what the circumstances are. So again, we are being persecuted, and, you know, there doesn't seem to be much defense for us. So again, that's the reason why I came up with Demotorized, to sort of explain the other side. And I hope that there is the start of some sort of movement against all these things. But we're against all the politicians, I'm afraid, and we're against politicians from all around the world who think we're bad.
Yes, it seems to have, in the last 10 years, really kind of rocketed to that kind of level where, you know, everyone is for the environment, or they're using the environment as every excuse. Where before, you know, you had a bit more fun and you had some, we had some great cars. You know, where are the legacy turbos? You know, where are the Impreza turbos? Where are the cars that you kind of, that you heard going down the road? You know, and people thought, it was like, you know, if you followed Richard Burns or Colin McRae, there was a kind of cult following, and you think, that was a car I'd really like to go in. And yet, I mean, we'd go to a local Subaru dealer in Northumberland, and the stories he had of his test drives were something else. When people would take an Impreza turbo and hear down the streets. And it was always quite a thing. But I think that's the thing, the enthusiasm for some of these kind of more specialist cars, or even just GTIs, you know, and hot hatches, which drove people. I mean, it was massive. Everybody wanted, you know, a proper car like that, you know. And I mean, there are some great cars out there today. It's just they don't, you know, either they're quite expensive, or they're not, people aren't able to maybe go after them like they used to. I mean, I'm a big fan of the Arbaths. I quite like the Arbath 595s. And, you know, you're getting a 1.4 turbo petrol, brand new, pre-registered for like 11.5 grand. And you're like, it's a bargain. And, you know, you get the some dealers have got the cheapest 500s at the same price, just about, you know. You know, so if you do a bit of shopping around, you can get yourself a really good little car. You know, especially if you're in a city, it's going to be, it's you know, it's narrow. You can get through the gaps and so on. And then things like the Arbath Spider, and they're going for like 16,000, and they've done maybe 10,000 miles, you know. And you think, that's a great car, because that's over, I think, so that 200 horsepower, and certainly a decent bit of kick, and it makes a great sound. So there are some good cars out of the kind of current crop. What do you think? What's one of your favourite cars out there just now?
I sort of struggle with new cars because, as you know, I sort of specialise in the older ones, really.
Or you could be secondhand to make it. Anything in the last few years that you think has stood out as something quite decent.
Well, we do. We do have a relatively recent Golf in the family. And, you know, Volkswagen don't mess up the Golf. I mean, they might have done it with the Mark III, but the ones that we have here is fantastic. It's a, you know, it's a comfortable car. And it's just a car that does everything right. And it's got the right amount of class as well. You know, it's because people look at it and they go, oh, that's the Golf. You know, so it is regarded as a sort of a boring cooking car. So that I've always been very impressed with. I used to buy Golfs years ago, and it's sort of very much a return to form. But it's the sort of car that you can't go wrong with. If you say to people, go and buy a Golf, you know you're not going to tell them to do the wrong thing. I mean, it's very funny. I know that you wanted to talk about bad cars that were.
That was one of the big things.
But the thing is, there are, you know, it's a terrible cliche, but I'm not sure that there are any real rotters around. I think there are some cars that are probably too expensive that you look at them and you think, wow, that's an awful lot of money. And you're talking about the Fiat 500 there. And there's the electric one that came out the other day, and I think that's nearly 40 grand, isn't it? It's like,
goodness me. I just saw a thing about that. Yeah, I mean, that's never going to work. A Fiat at 40 grand is never going to work. All the dealers will be thinking, I mean, if they've got any hair left, they'll be pulling it out, thinking, how are we going to shift that? But, you know, it was like, I always remember we had a great Fiat dealer in my local town here, and in the early 90s, where I think Fiat was at one of its strongest points. And anything that was above like 10 grand, he says, we're never going to shift that. It's going to see its birthday if we're not careful. You know, it's been sitting in the showroom for 12 months, you know. But no, I think, it's funny how it's all. I do think there are some terrible cars, or I suppose they're just more, they're so dull and kind
they're
of
dull. That's right.
Not rewarding. They're just kind of just underperforming. Things like the Vauxhall Mokka, that's one of my least favorite cars. And things that even the Ford EcoSport, I think that's just, oh goodness, you know, it's, and yet they're popular, right.
But the thing is, they are competent cars. They are cars that won't try to kill you, whereas if you go back 30-40 years, there were cars with very dangerous suspension, a bit like a Morris Marina, that would, you know, if you drove it in the wrong way, wouldn't be great. And I think that's what we've gone away from. But you are right. There are just cars that do nothing for your soul. I mean, there's always been cars like that. And in a way, we do sort of have to say to younger people, because I do see this online, is that someone sees a picture of an Austin Allegro and they go, oh, wow, what a fantastic car. They were terrible cars. They were the worst of the worst. Go on about Marina. You know, they see a picture of a Marina. They go, oh, wow, what? And no, there was, you know, there were cars that were just really, truly dreadful. And, you know, they should have rusted away. Keep one and stick that in a, you know, in a museum, but get rid of all the rest, because they weren't nice cars to drive. And they're still not nice cars to drive. But if you want to, you know, cherish one because you're an enthusiast, that's fine. I don't see any objection to that at all. But I think to celebrate a lot of cars that are in the 60s and 70s, which were terrible, and they rusted away and they broke down and they were awful, we should just think, nah, that wasn't a very good period for quite a lot of cars. They might, you know, they might look interesting, but actually,
they were terrible, weren't they?
Yeah, they were terrible, and they were so plasticky inside. I can remember my dad had a Hillman Minx, and it was just plastic. It was just everything. It was just, you know, when it was hot, it was just, you know, you could hear the steam coming off the plastic. It was just so awful.
And you had to burn yourself on the plastic seats.
Oh, yes, you would.
You get those trims that were like cotton, or the, you know, normal thing on the top, and then it was plastic underneath. So if you're in shorts, it was quite a thing.
Absolutely.
I know we're having some comments here about the FSO Polonaise, because we went to the NEC in 1992, and we went to the FSO stand, and remember we went in and we were fiddling with the switches, and none of them had any signs on them. So we didn't know what any of the switches did, and we pulled one and it came right off. And it was like, so it was, so we very swiftly kind of left, you know, but it was something else. In fact, I think it was at the same show. They had the old Citroen, was it a 2CB van? You know, they used to have that old, very, very kind of, it was like a bread van. And they were still making it. I think it was like 4,500 plus VAT at the time. You know, it was pretty cheap. But again, the stuff just broke off, and you think it wasn't, it just looked so dangerous. If you had a crash in one of those, that would be the end of it. You know, it was they were quite something. But one of our co-hosts said he had one, and he said it was very cheap, but the gearbox exploded twice. So it just showed you how bad those cars were. As it was, you say, at least we don't get that now.
No, we don't seem to. I mean, I speak as an ex-FSO owner. I actually bought one as an experiment in 1990, and it was terrible. Oh, and yeah, it was so basically it was a Fiat 124, but worse. And that was so rusty, it was unbelievable. It was a terrible car to drive. It was so heavy, and it was just awful. But it made for quite a good article that I wrote, so that was quite interesting. And I've got a picture of it that I use as my avatar on various places. People who know me as Banganomics will see that car, because it is truly one of the worst cars I've ever made.
Yeah. And they were I think they were about $4,500 or $5,000 new or something, weren't they? And they couldn't sell them, and they just couldn't get rid of them. And it was, if you tried to get a secondhand one, they were scrapped, or they were, because everything just broke, weren't they? They were shocking.
Well, the interesting thing about the Eastern Bloc cars through the sort of late 60s and 70s is that people were attracted to them because they had things that you wouldn't get as standard or even at all on British Leyland cars. So it was things like heated rear window was a very exotic thing. A tool kit was an exotic thing. You know, a radio, you know, it's really basic stuff that you would laugh at now. But I remember my dad said to me, Moscovich, he said, I'm really tempted because it's got all these extras on it. And I do remember at the time, I mean, I knew enough about cars as like an 8-year-old to say, well, I don't know whether that would be such a good idea, really. I'm sure it's pretty terrible. But a lot of people were taken by that. And that's why the Japanese cars did well, because not only did they have all the bits that were extras on British cars, but they never broke down. So that was the double whammy that changed, you know, the whole car landscape completely.
Yeah. It was like things like the Datsun Cherry and all these other ones. And what was the saloon that they had? They had that Datsun saloon that was very popular. I think my auntie had one. It was just a kind of, it was almost like how you would draw a car in a saloon, you know. But the thing is, they were reliable and they worked.
Yeah, that's so, it. And absolutely.
I think my auntie had also had a Talbot. Was it an Avenger or something before, or it was an Austin Avenger? It was quite a nice car, but it used to always break down. So she bought this Datsun. And then she drove forever. I don't think she ever got out of more than 25 miles an hour, and she drove from Glasgow to the Scottish borders. And I wouldn't like to be a passenger in that, to be fair. But it was quite a thing. But as you see, it changed it, and now we've got Dacia, and they actually make really good cars. I mean, they're just chips to run. I had a Logan estate for a few years, and I did about 50,000 miles in it. And average 70 to the gallon, and could take the family and everything. And it was so actually, it's funny how we used to laugh at the really old budget cars, but now the budget's actually quite good.
No, they're very good. Yeah. Again, a couple of years ago, I did write a feature about that, and I just drove it around to various places and sort of parked it up next to other cars. And it was, you just thought to yourself, well, you're stupid if you pay double the price for something that is pretty much the same. You know, then it really does boil down to badge snobbery. You just think, well, I don't. But there is a sort of inverted snobbery in having one of those, isn't there? So, but you can understand why people buy them, because, you know, it's good. It's good value for money, and that's all the most car buyers want.
Yeah, it's funny because they say that Renault, the bit that actually is making them the money is Dacia. That seems to be doing. They've done extremely well with them and across Europe. And I think it's partly as well because you don't have this crazy issue of, you know, an overpriced car that then is discounted heavily, and then sheds all that value after the first year or two, and then some people don't want them and they can't get rid of them, and it doesn't work. Well, the Dacia, you know, it holds its value fairly well, to be fair, not much to lose.
We
paid $7,000 for the 2-year-old one that we had, and it was a Laureate, so it even had air conditioning. That was its one bit, and it had traction control, but it actually handled. I had a Hyundai i30 estate before it, a turbo diesel comfort one, and it didn't handle that well. I thought something was going to be wrong with it. But the Dacia actually handled better and better ride quality. And the economy was even better. Yeah. And yet that car cost a lot more. But so I paid $7,000 for it when it was 2 years old. And when I sold it, we got over $3,600.
Goodness.
And that
me,
was 3 years later. I mean, it was like, it was absolute pennies, you know, and I mean, it was clean and it was decent. But it just shows you what you can get. So I used to recommend them all the time. Anyone who needed a family car, get a Dacia. And they were giving them away for about 150 quid a month, you know, on a PTP, because the residuals were so solid.
Yeah.
They were getting decent money back. And even today, I think it's quite a good car.
Yeah.
So it's funny how it's totally changed. I mean, you probably would have known, of course, about, you know, like the old Skodas, they were seen as quite bad. But to be fair, they tended to be a lot more reliable than the Ladas and things like that. They were quite reasonable.
They were very good. There was I'll tell you a quick story about a chap who used to live down the road where I lived as a lad. And there was a bloke down there, and he had a Skoda. But first of all, he had an old Mini, and it was rusty. And then he bought a Skoda, and it was very good value, and it ran for ages. But the important thing was the bloke who actually owned it. I remember my dad telling me, now, he lived incredibly modestly. He, you know, his house, he never painted. It was, you know, like a wreck of a house. And he had this Skoda. But the thing was, my dad said, that man is probably the richest man, you know, within 100 miles. He was the heir to the fortune of a shipping magnet. So actually, he was a multi millionaire, and he lived down our street. It was unbelievable. But he sort of eschewed it all. He just thought, no, I'll buy the cheapest car that I can. I think he kept himself to himself. He used to go rambling at the weekend. So he lived a very simple life. And in a way, it was wasted, because if that was me, I'd have bought an Aston Martin, wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'd have a new Defender and Safari trim and all that kind of thing, you know. it's funny.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? But that does appeal to some people. They just think, yeah, it's the basic. But you are right. Those very early Skodas were actually very, very good. I know that they were the butt of jokes, but they were far better in engineered than those rebuilt Fiats that were called FSOs.
Yeah. My mum had a Skoda Felicia, which was better than when it wasn't the Fabia. It was there was another one that they brought out, the first one that they had. So this was kind of the replacement.
Yes.
And it like literally cost £200 more than the original car, or the one that replaced it. And I think she got it for like £6,995. She had it for 4 years, and she got it brand new. It was the first brand new car she'd had in years. I think she traded it in. She had an old Montego diesel, and she traded that in and got this Skoda. And I think she did like 90,000 miles in it in 4 years. So it'd been all over. It'd been to the Czech Republic. Just after the walls came down, she went over to go there in it. And it never broke down. It was absolutely fine. And in the snow, it was absolutely astoundingly good.
It was really brilliant.
I think it was so light. It was a little 1.3 petrol.
Yeah.
But it was. And I remember where they used to live. They were up a very steep hill, and we had bad snow one winter. And my mum was quite a kind of fierce driver. She'd get on and wouldn't really hold back. And she overtook a neighbour who was driving a brand new Land Rover Discovery and was struggling to get up the hill through the snow. And my mum just came right out and overtook her. And this was about 300 or 400 foot up. You know, it was quite a hill. And when she got up to the top and turned off into her driveway, the neighbour pulled in their Discovery and said, "What on earth is that? Is it some kind of rally car?" You know, because you got in there, you overtook me, and I've just paid how many £1,000 for this big Discovery. And you know, it's a 6 grand Skoda, you know. And it was like, so it was, you know, probably was on, I suppose it may have had winter tires potentially. But it was incredible. They were so good in the snow. It was quite a machine, and it was quite fun to drive. It used to handle really well. So it would put a smile on your face as much as in your wallet, you know, when it was paying next to nothing for them. But going on from that, we kind of talked a little bit earlier before we came on live. If there was a car you could kind of bring back from the dead that's no longer made, would it, you know, that you could go into production, what would it be for you? What would be the car you're most likely to see?
I like most old cars, really. The list would be incredibly long. But I used to like the old Jaguar XJ6, which I think, you know, Jaguar sort of lost their large car mojo in the last few years.
That was
a very, very, it's such a comfortable car to drive. It looks fantastic. It didn't cost a fortune, and especially when used, it didn't cost a fortune. And I think if you modernize one of those, I think that would be fairly spectacular way to travel. I think we've just lost our elegance with some of the older, with the newer cars. Yeah. They just don't seem to be coherently, designed. And for me, the most disappointing is BMW's modern cars look progressively worse. So basically, anything they did from the 70s and 80s and 90s, you just think, just bring those back, just update, the mechanical bits, but keep the style, because that's, that's what made them great. And they're just sort of caricatures.
It's absolutely true, because we were in town yesterday and we saw the new BMW 1 Series. Both me and my mate Jonathan said, no, that really doesn't look right. It just doesn't have even the original 1 Series was quite an angular car, and it was quite a good looking car.
Yeah.
And it was seen as the runt of the family. I mean, it wasn't really the most, great looking machine out there. But the new one, I'm just not so sure about. And of course, because car makers make every kind of car, they've got a niche for everything. But you don't just have as you say, the 70s and 80s and 90s had some great 3 Series. It was very distinctive, great car. No traction control. In the early days, so it was pretty ropey on a wet bend, wasn't it? They were quite a 3 Series would quite happily have you hopping around hedges if you weren't careful. But at least they did look good. I always think, I'm trying to remember that, it's just gone right in my head, but the Alfa Romeo, what was the 3-door that was a very famous 3-door that was in the late 70s and early, the Sud, the Alfa Sud.
Yeah.
And because all these manufacturers, they're trying to go retro. They bring back the Beetle, and they bring back this and that, but they don't seem to manage to get kind of something. And I thought, surely instead of making this horrible Alfa Romeo Mito that was never a great car, based on an old Punto platform, why don't they bring in a Sud, or do something and put on like a Giulia platform that's shortened up or something. And then you'd have a car that I think would genuinely be a lot more interesting. I'm sure you know your history of the car is much better than me, so you would know there's some great cars out there they could do. But I think it's true, but the XJ6 was a lovely car.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. But you see, you've gone on to quite an interesting point there, which is about the number of models that manufacturers have. I mean, it is bewildering, really. And I think, again, they've probably lost their focus because they're making so many different kinds of models. And I don't know whether there is that much demand for, all the different segments that they're in. They're sort of trying to please too many people. I mean, when I was selling BMWs in the 80s, there was four kinds of cars. There was the small one, which was the 3. There was the medium one, which was the 5. There was the large luxury one, which was the 7. And there was the coupe one that was 6. And that was
that's
it.
Right.
That's all they had. Yeah. And that was really all they needed. And you just think now they're in so many segments and areas, I think they just lose their focus. But, they're trying to become giant companies. It is very difficult to, you and I unfortunately don't run a car company. I'm sure we'd find it quite difficult and quite stressful that you've got to make money, and you've got to sell loads of cars. And factories aren't things you can turn on and off. But we were lucky again that we lived in an era when there were cars made for enthusiasts. And that isn't something that seems to be done anymore. And the point you make about the Subarus, because Subarus don't make exciting cars anymore, do they?
Yeah, they're gone. It's absolutely gone. Dreary.
It's unbelievable.
The turnaround is horrendous. Mm. And you think from a car company that was won, rally championships and everything, it's and even Mitsubishi, they had the Lancer and they had those incredible cars, and now it's all kind of sports pickup trucks and things like that, that are just, they're not really that. You wouldn't remember them. But before there was a kind of cult following. But what's quite funny is that when we go to our driving day at the Company Car in Action, there's always, it's quite interesting to see where the queues of people are going to be to drive the cars. If Alfa Romeo are there, there's usually a queue, but not because so much people want to drive them, it's because they're so bad at giving out the keys and organizing it that the queue goes miles and miles long. They have these beautiful Italian models that they bring in, and I think more people are kind of looking at them rather than actually looking at how they work the system. That everyone else has got electronic keys and it all kind of works, and they're still writing everything down and giving you the wrong key for the wrong car and so on and so forth. And then you've got BMW where there's a huge queue. But again, there's so much paperwork you've got to sign everything because they're worried about their insurance and 100 different disclaimers that you've got to sign. But then Land Rover and Jaguar, there are colossal queues. You go to that one, you've got to wait for about half an hour, because everyone wants to drive a Jaguar or a Land Rover. So their image must still be pretty strong,
yeah,
and doing well, probably maybe more even Land Rover than Jaguar. Mm. But it's kind of funny because there's still, I think they're maybe, they've got a great range, certainly with Land Rover, but with Jaguar, I think it's harder for them because they've got these luxury saloons and okay, they've got the F-Type as well, but it's, they're supposed to do their SUVs, but it's kind of, they've had some good few years, but now in the last few years, they've struggled quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, the image of Jaguar just hasn't improved. It's still seen as an old bloke's car, which is a great shame. They've sort of lost what they had in the 60s and 70s when it was the car to be seen in. And so I think, and they are a relatively small manufacturer, you know, compared to everyone else. You know, it's, you know, they have a very small area. The problem with Land Rover, but it's funny when you talk to owners, Land Rover's reputation for reliability is bad, but also that's borne out by the facts. If you look at actual statistics from warranty companies, they're the cars that break down most often, most expensively. But you talk to people, and we've had a bad experience, but we like them. We like them so much. We like the image. So they'll you know, they're a glutton for punishment. You know, if a car broke down several times, you think, well, I'm never touching that again. But for certain people, they go, I know they're not great, but just look at them. And, you know, in a way, you can't argue with that. And I suppose that's quite clever. But for the sake of jobs in Britain, you know, you just want them to get better.
Yes, and to be a bit more reliable. That's the thing, isn't it, Mama?
Although I sort of struggle, you know, I see people in their lunch hours specking up Defenders, you know, and you can get to £100,000 in, you know, 10 minutes, you know, just putting a few, you know, extras on a car. And that seems to be absurd, doesn't it? And where I live in the countryside, and farmers do not have Land Rovers at all. The only Land Rover I see is a Series 3. So that's, you know, it's 40, 50 years old. And that's one that is regularly used, and it's in a state, but it must be so reliable. Otherwise, they all use Toyota Land Cruisers, every single one of them, isn't without exception. So they know what they're doing. And I think it's a shame that Land Rover have missed out on that market now. You know, they don't make, you know, they make stylish cars for people in the suburbs. They don't make hard-working cars that do a job in the countryside. But I don't think they're complaining about it, because obviously they know their market, and they've got a very clever marketing department to do that. And I don't think they care.
Yes, and I think now they know that their cars will sell. I mean, the Range Rover does extremely well. But, you know, the Evoque, I'm trying to think whatever else, what's the one in the middle, the one with the V begins with the
Velar,
yeah, that, yeah, you see them everywhere,
yeah.
And then of course they've got the new Land Rover Defender, which I have to admit, I just do want one of those.
they do look good,
and when they're on Bond films flying through the air and doing all these things, you know, it does look spectacular. But you see, even a three-door is £40,000 to begin with,
it, isn't
you know
it? Yeah.
And you kind of wonder, I mean, I think the residual will be pretty strong in them for a while. I think, you know, if you get a nice color with the right spec, I think it will be reasonable, but it's a huge amount of money, you know, to do it. And even the last of the old models, I remember I was in Kelso and they had a Land Rover dealer there. And when the last of the Defenders were being made of the old model, they had these wonderful, they were very plain white three door, but they were long wheelbase Defenders. And there was a truck full of them. And this was the last bunch they'd ever made, and they were being dropped off. And it is such an icon that you kind of, you know, you think, wow, you just think, I want one of those, you know. And I think they were, at that time, they were going for the mid-20s or maybe a wee bit more than that. But I don't see those losing a huge amount of money over the years to come. I think when you get one, even the old ones are still worth quite a bit if you can find one. I was actually, one of the things I was going to ask you, there's a kind of American craze now called the kind of barn finding. And it's when they go into these old yards and, you know, somebody's passed away and they've left these old cars in a garage. Do you ever kind of follow any of that? Or have you ever found anything amazing sitting in an old barn somewhere that you've come across?
I can remember appraising a Citroen CX a long time ago in a garage, and it was so dark I had to do it by touch. So I had to feel where all the dents were, and at the end, and then value it. And that was fun.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the barn finds you do have to doubt. You know, you do think sometimes, I'm sure someone's just pushed that in there and, you know.
Sorry about that. It will go off. My wife will get it. That's gone. That's fine.
All right.
Yeah, it's okay. A live show, isn't it?
Well, there might be someone phoning in with an actual barn find. They might say, "Well, actually, in my barn, I do have some cars, but
a Chevette or something."
But it is one of those things. What people have is like is say, well, should I restore the car? Should I leave it in the state it's in? You know, there is that sort of thing. I mean, I didn't actually do a barn find, but I did go to Italy last year. It was a good job I went to Italy last year rather than this year because I wouldn't have been going. And I did dig out a little Innocenti Mini, which was quite a fascinating thing. And that was in an underground garage, and there were several other cars there that I was quite interested in. The big problem was the language, in that we were struggling as it was to do a deal and talk. And it was only the owner's 12-year-old daughter, actually, who spoke a bit of English, schoolyard English. So it was a very bizarre way to do a deal. But there were some quite interesting cars in there. There was a very old 2CV. There was a couple of Alfa Romeos, and I was but it was very, very difficult to actually, you know, work out what they wanted to sell and what they didn't, and so forth. And then when the car came back, actually they took a lot of things out of my car that they shouldn't have done, but there you go. But I blame it all on language barriers, really. But it is possible to find some old cars. I think there's less and less of them about. People are more and more aware of how valuable certain cars are. I was offered actually another Innocenti, and that's one of the weird things about once you're into a weird car area, you get a lot of people offering you cars. And I was offered this Innocenti, which did look like a barn find. I mean, it was so rusty. You know, it was, I don't think there was any hope for it at all. Someone had actually bought it as like a spares car. And it was you know, I think you would spend, you know, I don't know, 20,000-30,000 maybe, because it's so rusty, and that's on a Mini. And it just isn't worth doing. And that was in the back of a car dealer's car park. And I just passed it on to other people. But someone else I know who's having one restored said that, no, that's worse than my car. so I'd rather not, you know, even for parts. And even though they weren't asking a lot of money for it. It's one of those things where, it'll end up in your garage, and when you've gone, then it'll be a barn find part two, because you just didn't have the time to do it. So I mean, that's the sad thing, is that, you know, sometimes it's cars because they're broken down, sometimes it's a death in the family, and things like that. But, you know, again, the bad thing about older cars is that, you know, you don't want everybody to think that, you know, the car is worth just because it's old. You know, that it's worth a fortune. You know, you want people to have cars because they're going to restore them and drive them and enjoy them.
And get something out of it. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's it. That's the whole point of it all, is that, you know, there is no point in just staring at it or being too frightened to drive it. That's why it's fantastic when you go to a supermarket and you'll see a car that's 30 years old and you know it's being used all the time, because there's dents on it and there's a bit of grime on it and they're not cleaning it all the time. And and that's my approach to me owning my cars, in that, in the winter, I shouldn't drive them, should I? Because they're going to rust away. But, you know, what's the point? You know, what's the point of having
as well
the best
just
cars?
Do it. Yeah, you that's
just
the thing.
Do it. You know, just, you know, give them a clean afterwards and wash the salt off. But really, we've all got, and we're doing the green thing. If you've got a car, it's been made once, you know, you're not throwing it away and buying another car that's got to be made again. And that's the most environmentally unfriendly thing that you can do. People who drive old cars, they should be celebrated for it, because there's some real heroes, you know, who go to
ultimate recycling, really, isn't it?
It is, absolutely.
You're getting the best amount of youth. Now, I'm being told here by my co-hosts, who have been writing crazily here in the comments, that we're not being interactive enough, or I'm not being interactive enough with my comments. So we've got a few here. One of them has said you could call the Toyota coronavirus, because that was based on a Corolla. And there's been quite a few in there as well as to what they've been buying and things like that. One of them is saying my cousin uses a Porsche 356 as a daily commute.
Fantastic.
It's covered in dents, but mechanically sound. So now that's the way to go. I mean, I think I've told you before that or it was actually Jonathan who had written to you when I had the Citroen that I got 2 years out of a Citroen ZX that I bought for £100. It was an L-Reg diesel kind of base car, and it was amazing how it can last for those kind of times. But it's something. I love watching the. I think there's a program called Haggerty on YouTube, and he goes all around America to all the states and finds these incredible cars. And some of them he loves to go for, like the Mustangs and the old 1960s and 70s and Camaros and things like that. And they're actually quite cool if they look rusty. You know, if they're actually on their original paintwork and looking quite rough. So he'll find them and they'll be covered in a cloth and they've been sitting in some old scrapyard or somewhere, and the people who's had it, you know, has kept them aside. And some of them they get running again, you know, and they try and get them to go. And there's one that's called Turning Rust. And it's quite good because they go into the real countryside in America and find these old wrecks that have been literally sitting in a field for 30 years, never moved. And they buy it for $20 or something, the challenge is, can they get it running within, you know, 2 or 3 days? And there was some old Fiat coupe, but it wasn't the one that they had in Britain, like the Bertone one. It was like a 1960s Fiat thing that they had, or it was a Fiat, I remember it was an Opel actually, but it looked very similar to that. And they got it going. There were two of them, and they managed to get one of them going in a matter of hours. And yet this thing had been sitting there. They got batteries, they drained the fuel tank, they did, you know, they knew what to do with the spark plugs and all the kind of things, and they cleared it out of rodents and mice and anything else that had been sitting there. But it was amazing because it's kind of the ultimate, can you drive it out of the junkyard kind of thing, you know, and I think that is quite a way that enthusiasts are kind of going on if you're my age, that kind of thing, that kind of like an old car. But I see that it's 9:45. You've been very kind with your time and given us over 45 minutes to do it. So we'll round up the show. But look, thank you so much, James, for coming on the show tonight. It's been absolutely brilliant. And for all the people who have been watching and listening, go to Banganomics.com and you can buy Demotorized. And it will give you a good idea as to what's happened to the car industry, but crucially as well, how to get back and be an enthusiast and fight back by getting a great old car and keeping it going and not falling for all this stuff that they're doing at the moment. But is there anything you would like to say, James, to finish up with?
No, it's just to say, Hugh, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I do find that people who like cars on the whole are just great people. I think when you start to, and that's the good thing about having older cars, you get people come over and say, oh, I had one of those. And they'll talk to you in such a nice way. I find that people who like cars are very positive. And, you know, that is what gives me sort of hope for the future. I think that people are passionate about cars. And, you know, I think everything will be all right because of that.
Yes, exactly. I do remember going to a classic car show just near here, and there was a kind of scene from the 80s. It was all the 80s cars. They had Montegos and Astras and Opel Mantas and all these things. And I saw a Montego that very similar to what I used to have as a child growing up. And I kind of ran across and said, oh, Montego, I must have a seat in this. And the guy said, it's the worst car he's ever had. And it was like, you know, and I thought, oh, well, you know, he really didn't want me to go anywhere near it. But I was desperate. I said, oh, I've got to have a seat in this, you know. And he was totally like, oh, you can have it, but about, you know, it was like, if he had given it to me at a good price, I probably would have bought it. But no, I think, as you say, people who are car people are positive. We love driving. We love all the enthusiasm about the whole culture and things like that. But it's been great having you on the show. And once it's all recorded and done, I'll send you the links so you can put it out there or have it.
Yeah, I will do. Don't worry.
And that would be fantastic. But it's a pleasure to have you on the show. And I really hope things go well for you there at Autocar and for your book as well. I hope it's a big success.
I appreciate that, Hugh.
Excellent. If you hang on just a couple of minutes and I'll end the show there, but we'll go there. But you've been listening to me, Hugh Hattrick, and my very special guest, James Rupert. It's time to drive fast and try not to crash.